Hi, I'm Illinois Public Media's Lisa Braltz, occasional WILL contributor and permanent space geek. American Experience's Chasing the Moon documentary airs on WILL-TV on July 8th, 9th, and 10th, and is available for streaming in its entirety July 8th. It's 6 glorious hours of space, race, heaven. The story is told over 3 2-hour installments, beginning with early 20th century rockets, continuing throughout the tumultuous 1960s, and culminating in the first and subsequent moon landings by the United States Apollo program. In order to get anywhere close to the moon, humans had to have a way to get up there. Aerospace engineering professor Zach Putnam and astronomy professor Joaquin Vieira, both of the University of Illinois, talked with me about the development of rockets and the serious technology required to get us there and home.
My name is Zach Putnam. I'm an assistant professor in aerospace engineering here at University of Illinois. And I teach courses in space systems, and my primary research work is in entry, descent, and landing systems. So how we land a rover, say, on the surface of Mars, that type of thing.
I am Joaquin Vieira. I am an associate professor of astronomy and physics, and I'm also at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois. I study cosmology and astrophysics, and particularly kind of how the universe began, how it evolved, how we all got here. And I build things, and I make observations, and I'm a space geek.
So speaking of dangerous and complicated, I'm not really sure that a lot of people know that much about where rocket technology originated or comes from. Either one of you can take this question first. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the evolution of rockets up until the early 60s, before we had started having the really much more powerful rockets. We can talk about the military. We can talk about rocket planes. We can talk about whatever you want. I'm not sure which one of you wants to take that question first. But if you guys could discuss, that would be great.
The oldest records are from China. I think they have abundant records of rockets being used for military applications, around 1000 AD. Those are a far cry from, say, the Saturn V. So, and the reason I think that it started in China is they had basically abundantly natural occurring saltpeter, which they could use to make gunpowder, which was the fuel for early rockets. And, over time, that sort of spread. Rockets arrived in Europe several hundred years later. And they were used in the military, but weren't a major strategic kind of tactical weapon. And, of course, they were used for fireworks as well. If things really took off, I was going to say no pun intended, but maybe that's a good pun. In the early, late 19th century, early 20th century, there were some theorists like Tsiolkovsky in Russia and Oberth in Germany, and people starting to develop much more advanced rocket systems, like Robert Goddard here in the United States.
Jack Parsons later.
Yeah. So the first liquid-fueled rocket was built by Robert Goddard and actually launched from a field in Massachusetts. Earlier rockets using gunpowder, what we call solid fuel. With the world wars, military started investing a lot more money in this kind of thing. And really the first modern rocket was the German A4, more commonly known as the V2, which was built by a group that was originally Oberth was involved in. But eventually was run by Werner von Braun out of Peenemünde in Germany. And after the war, the Soviet Union and the United States basically took those Germans back with them home, where they continued to develop things. And the early U.S. rockets, like the Redstone, was largely a derivative of the V2, and not that much of a derivative, with an extra stage on top. I guess that was the whack corporal, but anyways. And all that technology development really was for, with the exception of fireworks, which are great, really was for military applications. The rockets that were developed and used in the early space programs were all converted IRBMs or ICBMs, designed to carry nuclear warheads.
Previous to the military application, one thing that always struck me as very interesting was the kind of interplay between, the military-industrial complex, as it were, back then, wanted them. But the people actually developing them for the most part, seem to be quite altruistic and genuinely interested in exploring.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the Germans, right? You know, they get derided for being bad Nazis. not a great thing. But yeah, there were all these actually in the early 20th century, all these like rocket societies. They were all over the world. And they were all trying to build rockets.
And there were movies, there were books. I mean, remember, this was the heyday of science fiction. So Jules Verne, H.G. Wells.
And a lot of these people developing rockets cited those people as their inspiration for developing these systems that had previously been science fiction were now starting to become reality.
And so it was, I think, largely one could make the argument, and probably other people have, I just am ignorant of it, that the people actually developing the technology were actually altruistic and wanted to go see what was on Mars and see what, you know, explore the solar system, but then they were kind of taken and diverted to these military aspects because that was where the funding was and technical resources.
So how were our early rockets, so the World Wars are over, the Soviet Union and the United States split up the scientists and bring them back. Were there differences in rocket technology between the two countries, or were they largely the same? The construction of the rockets, or what was different about the two space programs in terms of rocketry?
I mean, they were both derived from the V2, and they shared, I would say, definite common design elements like a liquid propellant and thrusters and a fairing. And I would say, correct me, is that the big thing was computational differences in computing. We had more advanced computers, and they had.
There were other differences too. These rockets were originally developed to deliver warheads, and the U.S. warheads were more advanced and therefore smaller, and so the U.S. rockets didn't need to be as big. The Soviet warheads were larger and so needed larger rockets. But when you want to then say launch a person or a satellite into orbit, that bigger rocket gives you a big leg up. So the Soviets were able to take the R-7. And basically plop Yuri Gagarin on top of it, and off he went. Whereas we took our rocket, the Redstone, and put Alan Shepard on it, and it didn't have enough power to get to orbit. So the Russians had larger vehicles and larger engines with larger thrusts earlier than the United States did. That's where a lot of the catch-up was done, where it was seen as the United States was being behind in the space race. And part of the reason Kennedy and that administration decided they wanted to go to the moon is that they knew that going to the moon would require the United States and the Soviet Union to develop an entirely new rocket. So it'd be more level, a more level playing field.
Okay, so going back to Mercury, talk about those rockets. You mentioned the Redstone rocket, which wasn't very powerful. It was enough to get Alan Shepard up there. What rocket came next after that?
Oh, well, after the... there were two flights on Redstone, which was Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom. And the remaining flights in the Mercury program were launched on the Atlas, which is another ICBM, a much bigger one. Mm-hmm. And those were able to go to orbit.
Because they were waiting for it to be ready? Or what were they doing?
Well, so there, if you hang around human spaceflight, you hear a lot about man-rating launch vehicles. And they still talk about it these days, although it doesn't really mean anything anymore. And the reason was the Army was happy. The Redstone was an Army rocket. The Atlas, I think, was Air Force. But they were happy to buy 10 of them and have only 5 of them work. Didn't bother them.
Yeah.
They just send 3 or 4 to the same target, and they only need 1 to get there. And of course, that's unacceptable if you put people on board. And so they did a lot of work to add redundant systems. And there's lots of great footage if you watch, The Right Stuff or any kind of semi-accurate movie about the space program in the 50s and 60s with launch vehicles just exploding on the pad
All
kinds of silly things.
Dangerous.
Or not going anywhere, just like the top, going off or whatever. Were the Saturn rockets being built this whole time? Like, that technology was being developed concurrently as these other launches were happening?
There were early developments, particularly for the first stage engines for the Saturn. So they were already starting to think about how do you build a really big rocket engine? You know, the engine bells.
It's huge.
For the F1, if you ever see one, the There were five of those on the first stage of the Saturn V. You know, could have swallowed these earlier rockets whole in terms of diameter.
So I'm going to shift the conversation to getting to the moon. But first, we need to talk about Apollo 1. So can you describe what happened in Apollo 1 and how NASA changed after that, or what they changed after that?
Sure. Well, that was a big breath. Go ahead.
I mean, what happened was there was a fire in the cockpit right prior to launch, and it was a national tragedy and disaster. And three of the first astronauts died. How they fixed it? So they changed the oxygen-rich air in the capsule. It was oxygen-rich, and I'm trying to think. There was a reason for that.
It was pure oxygen.
Yeah. It was.
And the reason for that was that they'd actually had accidents with people getting hurt when there was ended up being too much nitrogen. When the mixture ratio got off, they actually, I don't know if anybody died, but there were some accidents with that. And so there was a concern about managing the mixture ratio in the cabin air. And so they went with a pure oxygen system.
But did it force NASA to change its procedures or checklists? Like, did they not know that it was a risk, or like?
Well,
how?
So there was common understanding amongst the crew, the astronauts, and all the people that that version of the Apollo command module, the capsule part, the cockpit where the crew lived or was going to live, was basically a lemon. It was the Block 1 version. There were a lot of known issues, there was already in the works a Block 2 version. But this flight was going to be with the Block 1. And it wasn't even the day of launch, actually. It was just a dress rehearsal. And I was reading, actually, that they weren't as careful with safety as they might have been because they didn't bother to fuel the rocket because it was just a dress rehearsal. But there were all kinds of things. So there was a spark in the electronics. They had a whole bunch of flammable nylon in the cabin, in addition to it being pure oxygen. And once it went, once the fire started burning, the temperature went up, the cabin pressure shot up, and they couldn't get the door open.
Oh, that's why they couldn't get the door open? Because
the door also opened inwards instead of outwards, and so they were basically trapped. There was a pressure relief valve that they were supposed to be able to release, then the pressure would go out. But even if they'd been able to do that, which they weren't, there wasn't enough time, the pressure in the capsule was too high anyways, and it would have probably broke the system. The irony being that the reason the door opened inward and didn't have explosive bolts to pop outward was largely due to issues they had with the same kind of hatch on Gus Grissom's flight in the Mercury program, where his hatch blew prematurely in the ocean and the capsule sank because of it, and they almost lost him too. So he was adamant that it not be that way.
So was there a chance that Apollo would be scrapped after that, after an accident of that magnitude, before they ever even literally get it off the ground?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the three astronauts in there, they weren't like, I don't know how many astronaut names you know, but these were people that everybody knew. People knew Gus Grissom. They knew Ed White. Ed White was the first American to do a spacewalk. Gus Grissom flew on the second Mercury flight. Roger Chaffee had been on multiple Gemini flights. This was like, I think, even the prime crew for the first moon landing.
Yeah.
These were household names. It was a huge tragedy. There were definitely congressional hearings and all this sort of thing, right? And if Congress decides that you're too risky and you're killing off national heroes, well, they'll pull the plug.
But they didn't.
Right. And it was interesting, too, on the Russian side, they had more casualties, but for them, it was secret. So they would only announce the hero after he had succeeded and lived. And so it's an interesting, you know, it's a more open society, and we were seeing the tragedies as they happened. And it made us more cautious, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of information we didn't know about the Russian or Soviet space program until Gorbachev.
Yeah.
In the mid to late 80s. They were very secretive.
Is there a particular Apollo mission that stands out to either of you as being more important or elegant in its science, or something that was just really cool leading up to Apollo 11, let's say, before we landed on the moon? Just was there any one of those Apollo missions that just really, you know, was particularly cool or great to either of you?
Well, leading up to Apollo 11, the flights were all test flights, basically, to check out equipment, procedures, you know, with Apollo 10 getting very close to the surface but not landing. I always think it's a funny idea. What if those two astronauts had decided they were just going to go for it? You know, there would have been nothing that Mission Control could have done. They didn't. These guys were much more disciplined than that, and they understood that they were part of a larger program. But I think the not to take away from any of the other test flights, but certainly Apollo 8 was a really bold move. It wasn't part of the original plan. They decided in 19... I don't remember when they made the decision to go, but it launched in around the holidays in 1968, went out and went around the moon. Basically, the lunar module was not ready, the lander, and so they went and did a couple laps around the moon without it in the command and service module and came back.
And in that flight, I was going to say the same mission, because in that flight, they took, I think, which is one of the most powerful photographs ever taken in humanity, which is the Earthrise. And if you haven't seen that photo, go Google it right now. You've seen it. You probably just don't know the name. And what always struck me as amazing about that photo, which I've read in the last year, I always assumed that was like totally planned by NASA. Like they're gonna go around, and they're gonna have a camera set up, a Hasselblad, and they're gonna snap the photo when Earth rises. And you read the account, and it was totally impromptu and
NASA's PR machine was not what it is today.
And so I remember reading the transcripts, and it's like, you know, one astronaut said, "Hey, look at that. Hey, hand me the camera. Got it." And it's like, you know, this wasn't a digital camera where then with autofocus where you then go, look at, you know.
No, and they were taking it out a window.
Yeah,
and
pretty much nailed it.
Which were fogged.
And they're spinning.
Yeah.
And they're spinning, right? So they're spinning. It's a little window. You're in these suits.
And these guys were busy. I mean, it was a lot of work to keep the spacecraft running, to check in with Mission Control. There were lots of things, lots of tasks that they had to do that these days might be automated.
Right.
They weren't just hanging out, snapping photos.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think Apollo 8, you know, there's probably as many firsts in Apollo 8 as there were in Apollo 11. Yeah. They were the first people to see the entire Earth with the naked eye.
See the dark side of the moon.
To see the dark side of the moon, to leave low Earth orbit.
Sorry, far side of the moon, not dark side of the moon.
Well, they saw the dark side too. But, you know, they tested out all the equipment except for the lunar lander. They had, at the time, was the highest speed reentry on record of people. Lots of really cool stuff.
So what do you think was at stake for the U.S.? This is a big question. What was at stake for the U.S. space program when Apollo 11 went up?
Well, I think they've been working toward this goal that President Kennedy had laid out, you know, that we're going to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And Apollo 11 launched in July of 69. And if something had gone wrong, I don't think they would have made the decade. We might have still landed, but it wouldn't have been in 69. Not only would you have had to have another crew ready to go and a whole other set of hardware, but there would have been investigations. You would have wanted what went wrong to not go wrong again. So in a sense, it was the one shot to make that goal. I think you have to understand, too, that, you know, Apollo 10 had flown not that long before it and had done almost everything. They had tested almost everything, operationally, procedures, the flight hardware.
Had it gone up the same year, like just earlier that year?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it had. And that was extremely successful. I think it's hard to... So while they had, you know, they'd done all the rehearsal, they'd done everything right, at some point you have to actually land. And there was still a fair amount of uncertainty associated with that and how that would go down. So you could think of it as, you know, the success of the program in terms of their overarching goal really was all hinged on whether Apollo 11 would be successful or not.
So what if two scenarios? What if everything was delayed by 6 months? What do you think would have changed? Would the Russians have given up so quick? You think they could have made it?
No. But they didn't. We didn't know that at the time.
We didn't know that.
The Russians had their own Saturn V equivalent called the N1.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had tried to launch it four times, and all four times it had exploded. They really were not that close. But again, as you mentioned, I mean, as you talked about before, you know, the Russian or Soviet program at the time was very secretive. Yeah. And there wasn't a lot of information coming out about what they were doing and where they were.
But my impression also was once we got there, it was like the race was over and they kind of like, okay, we're done. But if they would have had another 6 months or a year, and do you think they still wouldn't have made it? No.
Sorry, I'm shaking my head. No, I don't think they would have.
I can't see. They can't see.
I think they would have eventually.
But not in a year.
Certainly could have. But I don't think a 6 month delay would have changed it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So I realized that I knew nothing about Apollo 12. Like, really did not know much about the mission that came immediately afterward. And I did a little bit of reading, and they had a lot of technical problems, like, right away at the beginning. Do you know anything about Apollo 12? Can you guys talk about Apollo 12?
So I get the Apollo missions mixed up.
Okay.
Because there's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
But so I looked it up, but Apollo 12 did have a couple of interesting things, right? One is they got struck by lightning.
Yes, that's what it was.
On ascent twice, which basically temporarily fried the power system in the command and service module. So they were on battery backup for a while. And they had spotty telemetry down to mission control, but everything worked as planned anyway. So there was enough redundancy and margin in the system that it still performed to spec, so to speak. They still went. The coolest thing is they did precision landing on the moon. And they landed, I don't know, hundreds of feet from Surveyor 3, which was an earlier robotic mission that had been hanging out on the lunar surface for years. And they were actually able to, there's great pictures of, I think it's Pete Conrad and Alan Bean were in the lunar module for Apollo 12, of them standing next to Surveyor 3. And I feel like that's actually spawned, if you look at pictures people draw and cool things for, say, sending humans to Mars, that frequently they'll have a picture of an astronaut standing next to one of the Mars rovers.
Yeah.
You know, well, that's where that shots came from. That's where the idea is. We actually did do that on the moon, right? We went and hung out with a previous robotic mission that was defunct, but was still sitting there.
So if you could talk a little bit more about Apollo 13 and how it influenced the rest of the Apollo program.
Yeah, well, so if you ever look at pictures of the Apollo spacecraft, you notice something that we don't do now. They don't have any solar panels. So they actually got power from fuel cells by combining hydrogen and oxygen to make water and generates electricity. And what happened is one of the oxygen tanks basically exploded. I think that they were almost to the moon. They were 2 days out. It's about a 3-day trip out to the moon. And when that O2 tank exploded, I took the other two O2 tanks with it. And so basically they didn't have any fuel for their fuel cells on the command and service module, which meant they didn't have any power. All they had left was battery backup. And you need the command module, the capsule in the front, for reentry. So they shut everything down to save the battery power they had left. And they went and hung out in the lunar module for the rest of the time. It was not designed to do that. So if you watch the movie, right, they have all kinds of jerry-rigged things to do with duct tape and everything. And they were very lucky to make it back alive.
Do you think that mission influenced how they did the rest of the Apollo missions at all? Or just did it put the fear into people? Like, you know, there weren't that many missions left in Apollo, if I'm not mistaken. They were like maybe four or five, four? They go through 17?
Well, there were four left. I'm not sure they knew there were four left at that point.
Okay.
Somebody probably did.
But they had finite Saturns, right? Saturn V's.
They had enough hardware built to fly out through Apollo 20.
Okay.
But the last three were canceled.
Yeah, and those are the three that are like Huntsville, Houston.
Well, so there's the one in Houston. If you go to Johnson Space Center, it's on its side. That is a complete flight article that could have flown. So it's an actual rocket.
Yeah,
one of them was used to launch Skylab.
Right. Yeah.
Or the first and second stage. And then the ones, if you go to Huntsville, Alabama, where Marshall Space Flight Center is, or Kennedy, they have partials. They're not complete, though.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that was developed in the early space program was the whole idea of, well, of mission operations. We have this group of people in a room, the Mission Control Center. You know, what is it they do? How do you operate a really complex space vehicle? And one of the things they did is go through and think about all the crazy things that could go wrong. And they had actually looked at what happened on Apollo 13, that they would have to use the lunar module's life vest, but they didn't consider it very credible, so they didn't spend much time on it. they were able to scramble, and basically the operational system they put together held up well enough that they were able to solve the technical problems that they had in terms of making sure the astronauts had enough air to breathe, et cetera, and keep them warm and get them back because of that operations plan that they had put in place. I don't know how much it changed the other missions. I think Apollo 14 got redirected to Apollo 13's landing site. I'd need to double check that, but I'm pretty sure that's true.
So why did they stop? Why did they cancel those last few missions?
TV ratings went down. TV ratings went down, right? That's what I've always heard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think this is in the Apollo 13 movie, that basically nobody was paying attention at that point. We'd already landed on the moon, and people were sort of bored with it, you know. And of course, Apollo 13 changed that, at least temporarily. But yeah, you know, NASA at the height of the Apollo program in 1966 or something like that was 4% of the federal budget, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's huge. NASA right now is about 0.5%. That's almost an order of magnitude difference in terms of how much funding NASA had in terms of its priority, right? That wasn't sustainable. The budget had already started, had already peaked, and was already coming down. There was a new presidential administration, and NASA had other things it wanted to go do. It wanted to build a space shuttle. It wanted to build a space station. And so the desire of the Nixon administration to cut the budget and NASA wanting to do additional things basically resulted in the cancellation of the last three missions.
And from a scientific point of view, everybody always knew that it was stupid to send people because it's weight, it's risk, it's cost. It's just easier and safer and faster and more efficient to send robots to go take your measurements. This debate was happening before that. You know, people knew, but the argument was, well, you're not going to inspire the people and get the support to actually fund this if you're just sending a robot to the moon. And once that was done, well, if you still want to get on with the science, you don't need to keep sending people. So I think that was part of it, right? The job was done. We got to the moon. We developed the technology. What are you going to do? Collect more rocks?
Go to Mars?
Yeah. And from a Cold War perspective, the race was won.
Yeah.
We made it. We did it with Apollo 11. So what are these other missions hanging around for?
Now, it's interesting that this Summer of Space programming is happening in the 50th anniversary of Apollo, and we're talking about this, about going back right now. Is that feasible in 5 years? Can we do it?
Well, I think one interesting thing that most people fail to recognize or appreciate is that if we wanted to go to the moon today, or even say in 6 months, we couldn't send a person there. We do not have that technology. Now, that's different than saying, have we lost that technology? Could we redevelop it or could we build something? Yeah, we could with enough money. But as of right now, we could not get there, like tomorrow.
Yeah, it takes time to design these things. There's no lunar lander.
Yeah.
And there's no one building one right now that's capable of supporting people at least. So there's a certain amount of time required.
Yeah. And testing. I mean, it's not, it's one thing to sketch it out. Oh, yeah, we'll take the old one and put some new batteries on it. But it's years of testing and going through all these. So it's, and money. It's expensive. It's engineers. Engineers are not cheap.
Yeah, so, most administrations come in and want to change what NASA's doing. It happened with the first Bush administration. Yeah. The Clinton administration came in and decided they didn't much care what NASA did. The next Bush administration came in and said, we're going back to the moon.
Yep.
That was in 2004. I remember watching that speech.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in graduate school, the Obama administration came in and said, no, we're going to go to asteroids and go to Mars. And now this administration says we're going to go back to the moon. The thing to watch with all those things is, do these much more ambitious plans ever come with the required funding. So, you know, if they were to propose that and then also say, you know, we're going to bump NASA's funding by 25 or 30%, you know, that's a lot more credible. But I haven't seen that happen. You know, whether we could go to the moon in 5 years, I'd like to think that we probably could with sufficient budget and an appropriate risk posture, right? Being willing to do more test flights and accept, you know, higher failure rates. Is it likely to happen? Without the budget, I'd say it's very unlikely.
For Illinois Public Media, I'm Lisa Braltz.